God, I'm afraid to open my mouth now. Good evening, everyone. My name is Beverly Douglas, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm like the rest of the speakers. Before I get started, I want to thank the committee. And Chris looked real cool when we found her, you know. And I also want to thank our tapers. You know, everybody keeps talking about tapes, but how about the people that tape them? You know, Ruth and Bob, I want you to know we appreciate you both and all of you very, very much. Anyway, I'm very proud to stand here before you tonight and tell you that I'm a sober alcoholic. This wasn't always the case. A little over 29 years ago, I stood in one of those mental institutions that you've heard talked about this weekend. And from the grins on some of your faces, y'all been there too, and I'm sure you guys know that. I was privileged to be out at UCLA at that particular time, and we had a new woman that come in on our ward just a few days, and I don't know, for some reason I was very attracted to this woman. You know how you are, your personalities just seem to go together. And then I found out that she was different than the rest of us. And she was being treated for something I'd never heard of before, and it was called alcoholism. And I kind of shied away from her after that because, you know, I didn't want anybody to think that I was associating with somebody that had that, whatever it was, because we were all nuts in there. And anyway, we had we went out on this little day trip, which is I think it was Kenny or somebody said, you know, they let you out on if you've been on your good behavior. I forgot who was talking about that. And it was aboard a fishing boat this particular day, and they were serving booze aboard the boat. Now, it's against the rules, at least it was in the nut house I was in, you know, to drink while you're in there. They just don't allow that. And but I've seen some of the other patients drinking, so hell, I had me a couple. needless to say, I was quite drunk when we got back to the hospital that night. And they kept me downstairs and fed me and tried to sober me up a little bit before taking me back upon the ward. And anyway, when we got in there, this woman followed me into my room. And she looked over at me and she said, "Beverly, I think you're an alcoholic." Well, now, I want you to know I have never been so insulted in my life. And I told Lenore in no uncertain terms that she needn't lay her thing on me, that by God, I was crazy. Well, I meant it. You know, I would rather have been called crazy than been called whatever this thing was, an alcoholic. In fact, I was so insulted when I seen my own psych the next day, I told him what Lenore had to say about me. And I said, "Now, Dr. Valentine, what do you think about that?" And he looked over at me and he shook his head. And he said, "No, Beverly," he said, "if you can just learn to face reality and learn to cope with some of these problems you have," he said, "I think you'll be all right." Well, hell, I had been coping until they got me in there. I'd been drinking. That's where I coped. I don't know what that poor guy did, you know. But anyway, he was the boss, and it sure sounded right to me. So I was to continue to drink for another 3 years. Now, I'm so glad I'm down amongst people that know how to speak English. You know, out there in California, I don't know what kind of language they talk, you know. I have a hard time understanding them. Anyway, I come from, hell, would you believe I come from West Palm Beach? That's where I grew up. Now, I can't remember what the occasion was, but I do remember we were sitting at the supper table. I had two older brothers and two boy cousins that lived next door. But Daddy still have never been able to understand or remember why this come up in the conversation at the supper table, because we were quite young. But Daddy had said to us kids, he said, "When you're old enough to go to work and earn your own money, and you can buy your own cigarettes and your own booze, as far as I'm concerned, you're old enough to drink and smoke." Well, heck, needless to say, I went to work at a real early age, huh? Yeah. I was 13 at the time. 13 seems to be the magic age for a lot of drunks. I did start drinking. And now I also hear a lot of people say they drank for a lot of reasons. I don't ever remember drinking for any particular reason. About that same time that I started drinking, the war came along. And for any of you young people here, that was the Second World War, not the first one. I want to get that straight right off, you know. Lord, it's bad enough, you know. Anyway, you know, it was like the whole world went on a party with that war, and there's a lot of people here that remember that one. It was a very popular war, and anyway, you know, I just joined the party. The only thing was when the party was over, I never went home. I'm still a party girl. I just don't drink today, you know. But anyway, by the time I was 16, I was a blackout drinker. Now, I was also pregnant and married, just in that order. Now, when I was growing up, nice girls didn't do those things. But today, I guess, heck, you got to get married. Getting pregnant is good a reason as any. You know, either that or going on welfare. That's what they do out there in California. Anyway, remember I told you I was a blackout drinker? Would you believe me when I tell you that I was almost 4 months pregnant before I even knew I'd been had? I kid you not. I was doing waitress work at the time, and I'd go serve a breakfast, and then I'd go throw up, you know, and I'd come back, and I'd serve another breakfast, and then I'd go throw up. And my boss was standing there and watching the action, and he come over and informed me he didn't think it was too conducive for good business, and suggested that I might see a doctor. So we had family doctors back in those days, and it was Monday, you know, and I figured I had the flu. Doesn't everybody on Monday? You know. Anyway, so I went to see Dr. Moses, and when I had finished, he said, "Now, Bev, before you leave the office, I want you to come in. I want to talk to you." And so I got dressed, and I went on in to see him, you know, and he had these great big old oak desks and great big old chair, you know, and he was leaning back in that old chair with his arms crossed, you know, and he sat there, and pretty soon he leaned over the table, and he looked me right straight in the eye, and he said, "Beverly, you're pregnant." Well, now, I thought about that for a few minutes, and I just leaned over the table, and I looked him right straight back in the eye, and I said, "Dr. Moses, I can't be. I've never been with a man." Well, now, he thought about that one for a few minutes. And he leaned back over that table and looked me right smack in the eye, and he informed me I was not the second Virgin Mary. I was real sorry to hear that. Anyway, I did marry this young man, and I lost that first baby, and we stayed married for 6 years. Now, I didn't quit doing what caused it. I just found out what caused it and took care of that. It was a bad marriage. It was a real bad marriage. I was constantly going to the same doctor, you know, with my nose sitting sidewise on my face, or my eyes blacked or bruised, or my neck swollen up or whatever, you know. And finally, I did get pregnant again, and we were still doing these kind of things, and I was still walking around with bloody noses and black eyes and whatever. And it was, I can't tell you the kind of a drunken marriage it was. This man was really into alcoholism. Now, of course, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I never remember hearing the word, but he would do things like scream at me when he would come in off of drunks and want me to help him get the bugs off of him, you know, and things like that. And he was such a young man, it was such a pity. But anyway, I finally went to the doctor after my baby was born. She was about 6 weeks old. And he said to me, "Beverly," he said, you really should, you two should separate." He said, "One of you is going to kill the other one." Because you see, I don't know what was the matter with me, but every time he'd swing at me, I'd stand up and swing back. Now, that's stupid. Stupid. But anyway, I did get a divorce when the baby was 6 weeks old. And get this, I left him because I didn't want my child raising that kind of a drunken atmosphere. God, you know, I think about that today. But Anyway, I wrote my mama and told her I was finally getting a divorce, which she had been begging me to do before I even married him. She was out in California at that time, and I had a very smart mama. She sent me a one-way ticket. No cash, just a one-way ticket. And so my baby and I got on that plane and moved out to California. You know, and here in Alcoholics Anonymous, as you know, we have a language of our own. And in some circles, this is known as a way to get away from being prosecuted, you know, if you've done something wrong. We call it geographic, yeah, oh God. He had sicked the loan people onto me and sent them all the way out to California. But anyway, I got out there in California and I did what I call return to social drinking. Now, I gotta tell you that one thing I had learned in that marriage, ladies, is you don't go to bed with a man first. You marry them first. And remember, I left him when that baby was 6 weeks old, and I'm telling you, by the time she was four, it had been a long, dry summer. I kid you not, boy. And thank goodness I met this young Irish boy. Now, we all know that all Irish Catholics are alcoholics, right? They're all in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. Believe me when I tell you, I married the only Irish Catholic in the world that didn't drink. This boy did not drink. And I remember we had been married a little less than a year, and he came home from work one night, and he looked down at me, and he said, Beverly, he said, I love you. But he said, you're either going to have to give up this drinking, or I'm going to have to go. Well, now, I said goodbye to Paul. And Mom and I were back together again. Now, you know, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, around the clubhouses, we have a lot of cliches. I guess y'all do here, too, you know, like think, and first things first, and, you know, and all those things. Well, I knew all about cliches when I got here, because my mama used to have cliches. And as I was coming out of my second marriage, mama was coming out of her fourth one. Well, I mean, now she was like us. She just didn't say them. She lived them. She believed in them. And anyway, we had just gotten home from work, and I had put the baby to bed, and we had gone into the living room, and she looked over at me, and she said, you know, honey, she said, we really ought to get ourselves some kind of a business to ensure Charlotte, my daughter, a more secure future. And it sounded like a terrific idea to me, and I had a little bit of cash, and Mama had a AAA credit rating. So we did. We got a business. A liquor store. And the fun really began. Now, what I haven't told you was my mama was an alcoholic, too. Of course, neither one of us knew any of this stuff then. And anyway, I was into the morning drink at this time in my drinking. I mean, I was progressing right along, boy, right on schedule. And what was happening, though, now with the morning drink, that instead of getting well, I was getting drunk all over again. Now, they really frown upon, people that are working in a liquor store, and especially if you have your name on the license and you're working in it, being drunk or drinking, you know. And it was creating a bit of a problem. And beside that, I was getting where I couldn't function. And it was very necessary for me to function at that time to support this child. And thank God I fell in love again. Well, I was really falling in heat. You know that, don't you? But God, it was love to me, you know. And this man introduced me to a thing called the barley sandwich. Do any of you know what a barley sandwich is? That's beer and tomato juice. It doesn't look like it tastes good. It didn't sound like it. Honey, I got to tell you, it didn't taste good. But you see, it was the only thing in my life that was consistent. And it didn't matter how it tasted. It worked. And that was the most important thing in my life right then. It sort of slid me into the day. And you see, I wasn't eating very often at that time. And that way, with beer and tomato juice, I was getting my booze and my vitamins at the same time, you know. And I did marry this young man. Does it sound like I got another problem running around in here? You bet I have, and I'm going to talk about it in a little bit. But anyway, God, anyway, I did marry this man. Now, we had been married just a short time, and I began to have some of the darndest symptoms you ever heard of. And I got to tell you that drunk or sober, there have always been two things in my life that have been my strongest motivators, and that's fear and pain. Fear and pain will motivate me into taking some kind of an action. Now, I woke up this one morning and was making up the bed, getting ready to go to work. Remember, I told you I was moving drunk and I had things to do, I'll tell you. And I'm making up the bed and the bedspread was wet. And I looked around and there wasn't a drink in there, no water, no coffee, no nothing, you know. And I thought, well, damn, that's funny. So I felt up underneath to see how the mattress was, you know. But it was dry. It was just top of the bedspread. But I had to get on to work, and I went on into the bathroom, went to wash my face, looked in the mirror, and I wasn't crying. The water was just pouring down my face. And, you know, and that's kind of scary. And my face wasn't even all screwed up like, you know, I don't know how some of you are, but I don't cry pretty. And, I mean, you know, the water was just pouring. So it scared me, and I went on into the bar. I always had a bar in my house, you know. But anyway, I went on into the bar, and I poured myself a couple of hookers. And I drank them down, and hell, I mean, the water shut off, and I just went on into the bathroom, got dressed, and went on to work, you know. And I got home from work that afternoon, walked in the house, and all of a sudden, right in the pit of my stomach started jumping. And the next thing I knew, my whole body was just jumping all around that living room floor. Now, you talk about being scared, you know, but I knew what to do, you know. If I could just get myself in that bar in there and get myself a couple of hookers, you know, I knew I'd be all right. Finally, I got myself turned in the right direction. My little old body just hopped on in there, you know, and I went to pour myself a drink, and there was no way in heck I could get that drink poured, so I thought, well, I'll drink it out of the bottle. You know, as you're jumping up and down, that's kind of hard to do. It's hard on your teeth. And so I could manage that one, but thank God we always got all kinds of little goodies from the liquor store dealers. And I had me a great big champagne glass about that big sitting on the coffee table and had a fish in it the day before. Thank God the aquariums came and I moved the fish over to the aquariums. And anyway, I finally got some booze poured into that champagne glass and got my face down in there and, boy, you know, and got some in me. And, you know, and the more I could get in me, the calmer I got. And I thought, God damn, boy, you know, what was that, you know. But I had enough booze in me now, you know, that cut right off. And I poured myself another drink, carried it on into the kitchen, you know, and started fixing dinner and let it go at that. Now, a few days later, I come home from work and I lay down across the bed. And when I woke up, I was on the floor. And I had mucus all in my hair and all over my face, and I had wet all over myself. And I vaguely knew that this was not the first time something like this had happened to me. And I was filled with fear. But you see, I knew what to do about it. Fear and pain. And I got on into that bar in there and I poured myself a couple of real good hookers, you know. And the fear didn't go away. And I poured myself some more and the fear still didn't go away. So I did the only thing I knew to do. I called a doctor. And he said, grab a cab, don't try to drive, and get yourself on in here. And I did. And I got in there, and they run me through a series of tests and sent me down to the psych. And that was when they decided that I was having epileptic seizures and that I was manic depressive and I needed to be in the nut house. And that was how I got out to UCLA. Now, as I said, I was continue to drink for another 3.5 years after that. Now, I'd like to tell you about my moment of clarity because that was really important to me, and I never want to forget any of this stuff. And I was in the same home that I live in today in Chatsworth. And my daughter was away for the weekend, and the man that I was married to at that time was about 5 or 6 hours late. Now, we girls all know where you men are at when you're that late getting home from work, don't we, honey? You bet we do. They're out with her. the ones who understand them. Yeah. Don't laugh, honey, because some of us were the ones who understood them. You bet. You bet. Anyway, I had waited just about as long as I could for him to get home, and I decided I'd have me a drink, you know, to ease my nerves. And I'd only had a couple, and here he come. You know how it is with a couple. And he looked down at me, and he said, "You're drunk, and I'm not taking you anywhere tonight." And with that, he went up into the bedroom and passed out. I was a little bit disturbed and angry, so I fixed myself another drink, and I walked from the den on up into the kitchen. And our kitchen faces the front of the house, and I stood there with my drink in my hand, and I looked out the window, and there were two brand new cars in that driveway. And I walked through our home, and it was a brand new home, and it was newly decorated, and the furniture was from Sloan's over in Beverly Hills, you know, and you know, it was the kind of a home that if you opened up the book of the Better Homes and Gardens, you'd have seen one similar to it in that book. And I walked on out into the backyard, and it was beautifully landscaped and well manicured, you know, and it was the kind of a yard that belonged in the home that belonged in the book of the Better Homes and Gardens. And if you could have seen us as a family, my daughter and my husband and myself, that's what we presented to the world. Was that family that belonged in that yard, that belonged in that home, that belonged in that book of the Better Homes and Gardens. You know, that was important to us. We had to have that front up there. And yet, as I stood in the yard that night and I looked up, I remember crying out, "Why, God, why now? When I've got everything that I've always wanted all of my life, all of those material things, why do I want to die?" And you know, I couldn't have told you that night, but tonight I can. What good is all you've got, all those things, if there is no joy in them? And you see, alcohol had taken all of the joy out of my life. It had taken me into a living hell of which I could find no way out of. And I think that Christ said something like that when he said, "What profits a man who gains the world and then loses his very soul?" And you see, that's what had happened to me. I had lost my very soul. And I remember walking on back down into the rumpus room and fixing myself another drink and sitting there and wondering, where am I? You know, how did this happen? What's the matter? And for the first time in my life, as I sat there with that drink in my hand, I knew it was not that son of a gun I was married to. I knew it wasn't the neighbors or the kids or the family or the jobs or any of these things that I have always blamed all of my troubles on. And that, of course, is the reason I had to drink, you know, by now. You know, I had to have some excuse for drinking now. I knew it was that alcohol. For the first time in my life, I was consciously aware of it. I mean, it just popped right out of the back of my mind and come right up here in front of my face. And at that very moment, I knew if I kept on drinking, I was going to die. At that very same moment, I knew if I stopped drinking, I was going to die. Well, what the heck do you do? You can't drink anymore and you can't drink any less. I did the only thing I knew to do. I killed myself that night. Now, I say that facetiously, and yet for me, that's what really happened. I truly believe that night I died. I woke up 3.5 days later in County General Hospital. Now, I got to tell you, County General Hospital's a long way from where I live. I had tubes up my throat, my nose, both arms, and both ankles. And I remember I couldn't move, and it was very difficult to talk. I say I woke up. Hell, I came to. No alky ever wakes up. And I remember trying to ask the question. We know what the question is, right? Where am I? Well, there was a policeman standing over in the doorway, and he looked over at me, and he said, "Lady, you're in County General Hospital." Now, I said, "How did I get here? I live in Chatsworth. We have insurance. We have money." And he walked over and he looked down at me and he said, "Lady, committing suicide is against the law." Well, now, I didn't know that. I might not have done it, you know. And then there is a member in our group that I was telling this story one night, and he walked up to me and he said, "Beverly," he said, "you gave a fine talk, but," he said, "I want to make one little correction." He said, "Committing suicide is not against the law. It's attempting suicide that's against the law." Well, now that made better sense, right? You know. Anyway, my psychiatrist had got word of where I was, psychiatrists, I guess they're called. You know, they frown upon you doing something like that. They think there's something the matter with you, and they put you on hold, you know. And anyway, my psychiatrist passed word on to me, and he said, "As soon as you're well enough," he said, "I want you to come up to my office immediately. I want to see you and talk with you." So I did. Mama took me up there to see him. You know, my husband walked in there. He didn't know where in the hell I was at. He was passed out, as I said, and somebody had sent the rescue squad. I think it was I know it was my psychiatrist. I had called him up to thank him very much for his help, you know, and to tell him I didn't need him any longer, and evidently I must have went out while I was on the phone with him, and he couldn't get a response, so he just took a chance. Since I was manic depressive, I guess they had been waiting for me to do this, to commit suicide. I didn't know that. Didn't even know I was suicidal. I'd never consciously thought of killing myself. Thought of killing him a few times, but not me. But anyway, he evidently had called the rescue squad, and they came, you know, and got me, and they couldn't even wake him up in the bedroom. So he didn't even know where in the heck I was at. And when he finally got up there to me, I came to, he came on up, and I remember him leaning over the bed and looking down at me and saying to me one more time, "Why did you do this to me?" Well, you know, for the first time I was able to look him right smack in the eye and say, you know, "Hey babe, I didn't do this to you, this is me laying here," you know. But he was always saying that to me, "Why did you do this to me?" Anyway, I went on up to see my psychiatrist, and he informed me, he said, "Beverly, you need help, and you need it desperately." And he said, "I can't help you." He said, "Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you call them?" Well, now, I didn't say anything to him, but I was thinking, and this is what I was thinking. "You son of a gun." I cleaned that up. "I've been coming to you as many as 3 times a week at $60 a whack. I have almost drank myself to death, darn near killed myself, and you're sitting there telling me you can't help me?" I was a little upset. But anyway, I didn't say anything, and I took the number of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing it wasn't going to work, because I'd tried everything there was to try, you know, including him. But I told him I'd call. He was the boss, and I was used to following directions, so I got on home, and I called our central office, and a woman answered the phone, and she said to me, she said, she didn't ask me if I was an alcoholic, and I'm grateful, because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. She said, "Are you having a drinking problem?" And I said, "Lady, I sure am." And she said, "Are you drinking right now?" And I looked around, and I didn't see anything sitting close by, and I said, "No, I don't think so, not right at the moment." And she said, "Well, can you hold off for a little while?" She said, "I'd like to send a couple of people out to talk to you." And I thought about it, and I said, "Well, if you'll make it quick." So I couldn't hardly wait for them to get there, whoever they were going to be, because I want to tell them all about that son of a gun I was married to, and I knew they'd understand why I had to drink like I did. But anyway, two ladies came. Now, you talk about selfish and self-centered. Now, these women were it. I want you to know that they were there for almost 2 hours. Every time I try to tell them something about myself, they'd start talking to each other about themselves. Can you believe that? And finally, after they got ready to go, they got over at the doorway, and they turned around and looked at me, and they said, "Oh, by the way, Beverly," they said, "you be dressed and ready to go at 8 o'clock. We're going to come by and take you to a meeting." They never even asked me if I wanted to go. Anyway, they came and we went. Now, from now on, I'm going to talk about a book. And this book is called Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics about alcoholism and how the alcoholic can stay sober. Sober means free from alcohol, period. They came at 8 o'clock and we went. Now, one of the first things I heard when I got there was, buy a book. So I did. I bought me this book. And I brought it home and I gave it the place of honor right in the middle of the coffee table in the middle of the living room. And the next thing I heard was, get a sponsor. So I did. I got me a sponsor. Now, I don't know about you, but I got me one of those kind of sponsors that says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. She was a whip. I kid you not. I'm glad to know that y'all got some of those here, too, you know. And then I heard, you know, get our literature, our pamphlets, and take them home and read them. And I did. I went to a meeting, and I got pamphlets, and I brought them home, and I read them, and I placed them all around that big book there in the center of the coffee table in the living room. And I went to more meetings. Y'all did that? Yeah. I went to more meetings, and I got more pamphlets, and I read them, and I placed them on the end tables, you know, on each end of the couch there in the living room. And I went to more meetings and got more pamphlets, and I put them on the nightstand on his side of the bed, you know. And then my sponsor called me up one day, and she said, Beverly, I'm coming over to talk to you. Now, when she said she was coming to talk to me, that's exactly what she meant. Shut up. She had told me this. She said, if by mistake someone should call on you at a meeting, she said, you stand up and you tell them your illness and your first name, and she said, and you shut up and sit down because that's all you know right now. And she was really serious about that thing, too. And I minded, boy, I'll tell you, I minded that woman. And anyway, she came over, and sure enough, and you know where she plopped her little old butt when she got there at the house? Right in the middle of that couch, right in front of that coffee table where my big book was laying. And she looked at it, and she looked down at me. I don't know what, people were always looking down at me for some reason. She reached over, and she wiped the dust off of it. And she handed it to me, and she said, here, honey, now read it. Now, nobody had said read it. They just said buy it, you know. So I started reading this book. You know, I don't know about y'all, but when I got here, I was so sick, you know, and I would read it. And by the time I got to the end of the sentence, I'd forgotten what the darn thing said. I just knew I identified with it, you know, and I kept sitting there shaking my head. Now, I want to tell you right off, I'm not here to tell anybody how to stay sober, okay? I'm going to tell you, you know, this is how I stay sober. I'm not here to tell you, you know, what you're going to get out of this book or how to apply it to your life. But I will tell you this, apply it you will if you're planning on staying sober. Because you see, I don't care how much you read this book, memorize this book, talk about it in meetings, spout it out from podiums like I'm going to do here today, until you take what's in here and live it, it has absolutely no value at all, none. It's only words. Anyway, I had a resentment when I got here. Of course, I didn't know what resentments was when I got here, you know, and I felt sorry for you people that had them. But being sober, it didn't take long. You know, it didn't take long at all, boy, and all these burning rages within me began to come forth. And my sponsor had told me, she said, now, Beverly, before you pick up a drink, you call. And all of a sudden, one of these burning rages came forth, and I knew that I had to get rid of it, and if I didn't, I was going to get drunk. And I was scared to death of getting drunk. I was terrified. When I first got here, I didn't know what alcoholism was. When I found out I had it, you know, then I wasn't sure I wanted to stay sober, and then in a very short period of time, I was scared to death I wasn't going to be able to stay sober. And anyway, I just knew if I didn't get rid of this resentment, because you had told me, you know, that I could get drunk behind resentment. But I could get drunk. It said that resentment was our number one offender, and from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. That's the only place in the book I know in the first 164 pages that uses the word disease. It calls alcoholism an illness, an affliction, and a malady. That's what it calls it in our big book. Now, I was scared death I was going to get drunk, and you know how we are, so I figured, well, I'll give her a chance to save me. And I called her, you know, and I was nattering away 90 miles a minute, you know, telling her about all this, you know, and she listened to me for about 2 minutes. And then she said the magic words. She said, honey, read the book. The answers are in the book. Have you ever had your sponsor do that to you? You just want to, you know, just, you know. So I got in here, and again, I started reading this book, you know, looking for the answers, you know. I'm going to inform some of you newcomers. See, I'm going to tell you a little secret. The reason they tell you to read the book is they know the answers are there. They just don't know where they're at. You know, they got you reading the whole book. Anyway, I started reading this book. Now, I got a couple of pet peeves, and I want to get rid of one of them right now. I hear people in meetings and from podiums who stand up and say something like this. Well, now you can just work this program any way you want to. Now, I don't know what book they're reading, but they are not reading this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We hear it read in almost every meeting, and it goes something like this. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. There is no S on path. Who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, I was like most of you. I knew all the answers when I got here. It was the questions I didn't know, you know. So I called her up and I asked her, what path are they talking about? And she said, well, read your book, honey. The answers are in the book, you know. And so I got in this book and started reading. Let me tell you what I found in there. It says, a lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, I know some of you were talking and some of you didn't hear me, and there's some of you that don't want to hear me. So watch my lips. I'm going to repeat it. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, it uses words like exactly, precisely, specifically, and it even goes on to say it gives clear-cut direction. Now, that really doesn't leave any room for the fertile imagination to run around in, does it? It's got you right by the... You know what? I'm glad to know that y'all know you know what. Now, it goes on to say that we've written a book which we believe to be moral as well as spiritual. Now, again, I don't know what that's going to come to mean to you. I can only tell you what it has come to mean to me. You see, I don't believe that my drunkenness was a moral issue. I have come to believe that my sobriety is. I have come to believe that my sobriety is a moral issue. And therefore, it behooves me to find out what my morals were. Now, all alcoholics do everything backwards, right? Not right, not wrong, just backwards. So I'm going to be a typical, and I'm going to start with step 12. Okay. I'm not going to run through all of the steps, so you can relax. But I do want to... the values and the principles that I have found in some of those steps that I've had to apply to my life in order for me to stay sober. You see, now, they say this is a we program, and I believe that it is, that we do this thing together. So when I'm talking about something that you identify with, I'm talking about we. And when I'm talking about something that you don't identify with, I'm talking about me. Okay? Anyway, I kept hearing about the three essentials. Now, I noticed that we had that on our little program there in one of the meetings that was around this weekend. The three essentials of how this program works. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. The how this program works. Now, in the first step, when I was able to take that first step, when I could honestly say, not just from the mouth, like most of us do when we first get here, but when I could tell you from my gut, I am an alcoholic, and my name is Beverly. From that point on, when I was able to really be honest, not with you, but with me inside, me, I was able to set aside the juice, and I've been one of the lucky ones. For whatever the reason, I've never had to pick up a drink. My birth date is September the 10th, 1965, and 9 more days, I'll be sober 26 years. And I'm proud of that, because there ain't no way I could get from there to here. My home group is the Canyon Participating Meeting in Chatsworth, California. Anyway, I forgot where in the heck I was at. I was able to set aside that juice, as I said, and never to drink again. And that was the how, the honesty, the beginning of the how. And I went into my second step, and in there, it said, you know, came to believe that he could restore his sanity. Didn't say he would, just said he could. You know, my case, my husband says I'm not there yet, but I keep hoping, you know, that one day, you know. Anyway, I had a little bit of trouble with that. Not in the insanity part, because heck, I had my certificate from UCLA, you know, stating that I was nuts. Now, you know, you and I both know that when they said I was having epileptic seizures, they were alcoholic convulsions, for God's sakes. You know, we know that. I didn't know it at the time. But I, you know, when I got to you people, I began to learn a little something about alcoholism. I also know that the manic depressions that I was having, you know, were induced by alcohol. They were induced by alcohol. And the reason I know this is because when I sobered up, somehow the manic depression just lifted and went away, and I've never been manic depressive since. You know, I get a little depressed some days, you know, because some days I have something to be depressed about. But other than that, you know, everything's okay. And anyway, I'm in this second step. Now, it said, you know, it began to talk, I began to hear spiritual. And I thought, oh, you know, God, you know, here we go, you know, religion. Well, now, I was raised, you know, as I said, over in West Palm Beach, and I still got a Bible today that they gave me when I was just a little kid for 5 years of faithful attendance in my Methodist church. But Mama let us go to any church we wanted to go, so I went to many different faiths and many different kinds of religious services and so on and so forth, and I knew it didn't work. I knew it didn't work. It gave me a temporary belief, you know, relief from my problems. But come to think of it, I only went there temporarily too, you know. As soon as things got straightened out, I quit going. But, you know, that didn't connect to me at the time. But I knew that this spiritual thing wasn't going to work. But my sponsor told me, she said, Beverly, she said, don't assume the meaning of words. Get into your dictionary and begin to look them up even when you think you know them. And so I did. I got into that dictionary and I looked up the word spiritual and spirituality. Because I couldn't connect with religion because I knew it wasn't going to work for me. And let me tell you what I found for me. It simply said that being spiritual was an elevation of thought and feeling. Well, God, all I had to do is look at the kind of a drunken woman I was when I was drinking. When I sobered up, I got to tell you, it was just automatic. It was just an automatic elevation of thought and feeling, you know. And anyway, so, you know, I got that one out of the way. Now, it says there that, you know, that we don't have to buy it all right now. All we have to do is keep an open mind. Well, God, that was easy for me. My mind was wide open. Anyway, so now I have the principle of open-mindedness. So I've got honesty and open-mindedness now. And then I went into my third step. And in that third step, it said we made that decision to turn our life and will over to the care of God. And I thought, oh, God, here we go again. You know, we're off to this God thing. Well, now, I was real iffy when it came to God. I got to tell you, I was just real iffy. I was just like a lot of you are. And remember I told you fear and pain was my strongest motivator? Let me tell you what I remembered about that time. And it was, I can't remember where I read it from or where I heard it from, but it went something like this. I would rather live my life as though there was a God and die and find out that there wasn't, than to live my life as though there was no God and then die and find out that there was. Now, I don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me when I remembered it, I'll tell you. And I decided real quick I was going to act as if. Now, I had a problem with that because when I got here, my sponsor said, honey, you were a phony all those years you were out there. And she said, now that you're here in AA, she said, you're going to stop being a phony and you're going to tell it like it is. And I got into these meetings and new people said, that's okay if you don't believe in God, you know, just, act as if. Well, now that was confusing to me until I remembered this. And I decided real quick I was going to act as if. So anyway, I went into that third step, and what I got, the principle I got out of that, was willingness. So I now have the three essentials of how this program works. I can't, he can, so let him. Okay? Now, by this time, I'm 3 years sober. Not that I'm slow, but I was glad to hear there were some other slow ones around here, too, beside me. But anyway, you know, the first thing I wanted to do was to get a divorce when I got sober, because I sobered up and seen that that son of a gun was doing to me what I thought he was doing. And I didn't like it. And Eunice had told me, she said, no way, Beverly. She said, you're going to get a good, firm, basic program. You're not going to make any decisions for at least a year, and in your case, you're sicker than most. I want you to wait 3. I kid you not, that's what she said to me, and I'm glad that she recognized. Recognize the fact that I was that sick, and she said, you know, don't throw away anything yet, it might be something good and you'll be sorry later on. So anyway, and then she said, don't get emotionally involved, and well, I didn't have any trouble with that. I don't know exactly what she meant by it. I really wasn't too concerned because I was married, and when I'm married, I'm married. And when I'm single, it's something else. Anyway, and then she added a little addendum on it, and she said, by the way, honey, she said, there is a clubhouse here in the valley, and she said, it's called the Allen Nest, and she said, I want you to stay away from there. She said, there's a bunch of dirty old men there helping women with their spiritual program. Y'all got one of those there, too? I hope you have. That's good. And they will. They'll help you with your spiritual program, but save them until later until you get a good basic program behind you because you're going to need it. Okay? Anyway, I decided, you know, by this time, I didn't leave this man because he was still drinking. I think that I could have lived with that for a while longer, but he was a womanizer. And I was beginning to get a little of this self-worth that's talked about in our program. And I decided that, you know, either I was going to have to, to leave him, or I was going to be back on the juice. That was the way it was affecting my life. And as I said, I sure didn't want to start drinking again. So I had to make that decision. And I don't advocate divorce because I have seen many marriages turn out far better than they had ever been when one or both got sober. But anyway, that wasn't to be the case for me, and I went through a divorce at this time after I'd been sober for 3 years. And hell, I'm not dumb. You know where I headed. right, straight over to Allen Nest just as fast as I could get there. And I sat there and I looked around, you know, and I was just like a little kid in a candy store. I said, I'll have him, and him, boy. And then I realized I was in deep trouble. I was in heat again. God. Scared to death. Just absolutely scared to death. And I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. Now, at home, we have gurus. I brought one of them along with me this trip. And you'll be hearing from him in the morning. Have we got any gurus? I know you got gurus here. I'll bet that traveler is one there. And I know we got a couple over here that are gurus. And where is, y'all point out a couple of your gurus here that y'all have, you know. Anyway, if you guys got one back there, okay. If you guys have got any of these gurus for sponsors, I know that they're probably teaching you one of the things they teach our guys out there. And that is, you know, to stay away from the women when you first get sober, because behind every skirt there's a slip. This man knows we got a guru over here. See, I knew they'd show up. Don't you sit back there and laugh, honey, because behind every slipper there's a zipper too. You bet. Oh, Lord. And I knew I was in trouble. I knew it. You know, I got to tell you a little story. Y'all just bear with me. Everybody's been telling stories, and God knows I don't want to miss out on anything, you know. There was this little doggie, and he lived with this family by a railroad track. My mama told this to my brothers when they were both going into the service, and I was eavesdropping on this, you know. And anyway, there was this little doggie, and he lived by this family by a railroad track. And he woke up this one morning. It was a beautiful spring day outside, you know. And he wanted to go play, so he let out a couple yips and scratched on the door, you know, and his owner got up out of bed and come let him out. And he ran up on this little tiny hill here where this railroad track was. And he was running along the railroad track, and he was sniffing at the weeds and sniffing at flowers, and his little ears were just blowing back in the wind, you know, and he was having the most wonderful time. And along come a train and cut off a little tiny wee piece of his tail. Well, now he let out a yip, and he turned around to see what happened to that little tiny piece of tail, and a train come along from the other direction and cut off his head. Now, honey, don't you be like that little dog and lose your head over a little tiny piece of tail. Ain't that what we do? You betcha, honey, you know. She got part of it gone already. She lost it last night. Oh, Lord, and I knew I was in trouble. You know, I hope I'm not offensive to anybody in talking about this. You know, but I think it's so important, and I don't think it's talked about enough. We lose more members here in Alcoholics Anonymous behind these problems than any other here in our program. But I'm smart. You see, I'm thinking by this time. God help you when you start thinking. Now, I was beginning to pick up some babies of my own along about this time, and I was teaching them the same things that I had been taught. And that is that you get a good, firm, basic program. You don't get emotionally involved, you know, with right away, okay? I told him right in behind this, honey, but if you need to get laid, that's all right. I see you think like I do. You see, I figured if they could get laid without getting emotionally involved, they could come back and tell me how, and I'd be okay, right? Oh. I'm talking about we now, aren't I? You bet. It doesn't work. And you guys need to laugh, because by God, I ain't seen it work any better for y'all than it has for us. Since being married to an alcoholic on this program, I've had the privilege of holding some of you men in my arms as you've cried over some of these little affairs you've been practicing your principles in. You know, my sponsor had told me, she said, Beverly, she said, you look like a woman, and you dress like a woman, and occasionally you talk like one, but she said, I don't think you know what it is to be a woman. And she said, I want you to go to some women's SAG meetings. Well, now, I mean, that was going just a little bit too damn far, you know. And I told Eunice in no uncertain terms, I said, Eunice, I am not going to go to those PTA meetings with those gossiping, backstabbing bitches. And she looked over at me and she said, you're going. So I went. And sure enough, when I got into those CTA meetings, I found some gossiping, backstabbing bitches. But let me tell you what else I found. I found some very warm, wonderful women who literally saved my life. Who literally saved my life. Now, I remember that we were... It was after one of these PTA meetings was over with, and Eunice always had her little group around her all the time. Of course, I had been invited in to be one of her entourage. And we were sitting there in the meeting after it was over, and I think that what I was doing was threatening Eunice with getting drunk. I used to do that when I'd get mad at her and trying to scare her, you know. And she looked around at me and she said, let me tell you something, Beverly. She said, you can either pick up the 12 spiritual tools that we have here to work with and stay sober, or you can go ahead and drink, you know, and walk through the gates of insanity or death. Now, what are you going to do, honey? And I sat there and I looked at her and I thought, she's threatening me. And I said, you must give me a few days to think about that, will you? Now, who else but a drunk is going to need a couple of days to think about whether they want to walk through the archway of freedom or through the gateways of insanity or death, you know? But I was serious about that thing. And I think that I must have said a few more words to her, you know? And she got up to walk away, and she stopped, and she came back, and she looked down at me. And... because I wanted to know, she was my sponsor and she was supposed to do something, you know, for me. And she looked down at me and she said, let me tell you something, honey. She said, if you decide to get drunk and commit suicide, she said, I just remembered you're suicidal. And if you decide to kill yourself again, I want you to know I'm not going to be responsible for that either. And I said, well, hell, you're my sponsor. What are you supposed to be responsible for then? You know, you got to be good for something. And she picked up my book, and she shook it down right in my face, hit me right across the bridge of the nose. I'd like to think she didn't mean to do that. And she said, I'm responsible for helping you to learn what's in this book and how to apply it to your life. She said, that's what I'm responsible for as your sponsor, nothing else. She said, from then on, the responsibility is yours. Well, anyway, I went into these darn old PTA meetings with this woman. But I kid you not when I tell you that it is the women that have saved my life. Now, the men have helped me with my spiritual program now and then. In fact, you know, when I was sitting up there at this clubhouse, this Allenette, my mother and my daughter had gotten together a couple of days before, and they were going through the dictionary like I had been taught, and they had come up with how I was prior to coming into AA, and they had come up with two words, submissive and subservient. And that's kind of a person I was. I was very submissive and subservient. And I had gone to the meeting the next day up there at the clubhouse, and I was sitting there talking about this and how submissive and subservient I was, and there was this young man sitting in the meeting, and he was tapping on the table, you know how they are when you're talking, you know, and they've got something important to say. And finally, I finished what I was saying, and they called on him. And he looked over at me, and he pointed his finger right straight at me, and he said, "Lady, did you ever stop to think that all you ever really was just a kiss ass?" He hurt my feelings. But I got even with him. I married him. We women do have a way of getting even, guys. Might take us a while, but we'll get there. You know, I got to tell the ladies something, too. You know, I don't care from where you come from when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you've been the biggest prostitute out there on the streets, when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have been reborn. Now, if you don't believe me, you watch these men watching these newcomer women. They can't hardly wait to be the first one. They really think they're going to be the first one, too, you know. When you guys are going to start getting better is when you're going to want to start loving the hell out of these women instead of the hell that's in them. And when your program is really going to improve is when you want to be the last one in these women's lives, not the first one. That's going to improve it. You know, I always used to think that it was poor little O'Neill that was always so abused by you guys. Really did. I have learned that you men do cry, that you do hurt, and I used to think you just walked away from these little affairs scot-free. So let's us women remember, these men do cry, they do hurt. They do not always walk away scot-free. I've met some of these women on this program, and I'm telling you, we got some real barracudas in this. So let's us be as honest and as kind and as gentle with them as we would want them to be with us. I think that's only fair. Yes, sir. Anyway, I'm in heat and I'm in trouble and I'm full of fear one more time. Fear and pain back in my life because I am scared to death that I'm going to end up back on the juice again. And so by this time now, I have got into my fourth step. And in my fourth step, I have learned the principle of truth. Because in there it says that we are going to do some fact-facing and some fact-finding now. And so I took a look. I took a look at these men that I had chosen in my life. Let me tell you, you know what they were. They had charm, polish, and prestige. They were good-looking, fun-loving, hard-drinking, party-going, woman-chasing. God damn, what a challenge, huh? Whee! And we got them. Oh, Lord, we got them. Damn near killed us, but we got them. And like was told earlier this afternoon from our Al-Anon sponsor, and we alcoholic women aren't any different. When we get them, we're not going to let go of them because we know what's going to happen. She's going to get him. And when she gets him, he's going to sober up. He's going to become a faithful, loyal, hardworking husband. He's lost. We're not going to let go because we know they have such potential. Yeah. God, when I hear that word, I want to throw up. They've got such potential. And so we hold on to them. And that's what I did. And that's what we do. And Lord, I learned to let go and let God. Remember, I got those out of my first three principles. I can't, he can, so let him. And I was real willing to let him, I'll tell you, because of the pain and the fear in my heart. Now, I'm going to skip over the fifth step, and I'll come back to that. I think my time is about to run out. I don't know when I started. It's not running out yet. Okay. What time is it supposed to run out? Okay. Anyway, here I am, and I'm in this problem, and I don't know exactly what to do, and I'm doing now everything I can. Now, as I said, my principle there was, in my sixth step, it talks about, I am going to quit here in a few minutes, I really am. I went into my sixth step, and in the sixth step, you know, where it says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character, right? God knows I was entirely ready. Now, I got to tell you, in there, I learned the principle of courage. And I think it was Ken that talked about it yesterday morning when he said courage is the word that means from the heart. From the heart. I was entirely ready because I was scared to death. You know, they talk about this being a selfish program. I got to tell you that everything that I have done in this program, I have done for selfish reasons. Because of my fear and pain and afraid that if I didn't do what I was told to do, that I was going to end up back on the juice again. And beside that, I found out when I did these things, I felt so much better. I just felt so much better, you know. And so I became entirely ready. I got the courage. In the fifth step, now I had learned the principle of trust in that fifth step, and now I've got the courage to go with that trust. And in the sixth step, and in the seventh step, you know, where it said that we humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings, in there was where I got the faith to go with the trust and the courage. Now, on the 21st of August, just a couple of weeks ago, you and I celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. And on Thursday, August the 22nd, our doctor informed us that my husband has lung cancer. Now, the central fact in our lives today, and this comes through our third step, is an absolute fact. Absolute. That our Creator has entered into our lives in such a way. In such a way that it's an absolute miracle. And that He is accomplishing for us today what we could not do by ourselves. And I remember when I got into our fifth step, as I said, I learned the principle of trust. And in that fifth step, it says that we have to tell someone all of our life story, all of it, omitting nothing. For if we do, we may not overcome drinking. And in fact, it goes on to say that invariably we drank again. Now, I don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me when I read it. And I didn't know what to do because, you see, I didn't trust my sponsor. Eunice had a big mouth. Oh, God, she had a big mouth. And I knew the minute I told her my life story, she was going to come and tell you, and you were going to ask me to leave, that you didn't want me. But you see, as I said, I had come to trust in this God. Not Eunice. Not man. But in God, as I understood Him. And so I went to Eunice and I told her all of my life story, omitting nothing. And in doing so, Eunice shared a part of her life with me. And we developed a relationship, and it became a relationship of love. And as I then began to sponsor other women, and they came to me, and they shared a part of their life with me, we also developed a relationship. And it became a relationship of love in most cases. And isn't that what this book is all about? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book, our program, is all about. Exactly. Now, I have one more pet peeve, and I'll get rid of that. We have a man over in our area, and I have heard him stand up at podiums and repeat something like this. I'd like to think that he didn't mean the way it sounded. Today, I no longer have a drinking problem. I have a living problem. You ever heard anybody say that? If you're an alcoholic of my kind and you hear somebody say something like that to you, for Christ's sake, run. They can kill you. I came in this program and to you people because I was dying from alcoholism, from drinking alcohol. Not because of the problems I had. Not because of the problems I have today. But from drinking alcohol. I have living problems today. You darn right I have living problems. Hell, I'm breathing in and out. Do you know of anybody that's alive that doesn't have living problems? Are you like me? Did you come in here and think because you sobered up you was going to be immune from life and its problems? Because if that's what you've got in mind, let me tell you, you're in for one hell of a ride. There is a saying in this book that has held me in good stead. And I think it's terribly important for me to remember. It says, just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us and humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. And as I close here tonight, I want to wish for each and every one of you all of the things that I have found. You see, because when I got rid of self-righteousness, I gained some self-worth. I want to wish for you all the joy, all the sorrow, all the angers and frustrations, all the peace and contentment. Because you see, I thoroughly believe this, is that when our defects are removed, that we are left with just a few things. And that is harmony and peace and absolute love. Absolute love. And as I close, as I said, for each and every one of you, all of these things I wish. Because you see, these things are life. We are not immune from life. We're living life today. And that's what my husband said to me. He said, honey, I'm not dead yet. Don't bury me. You know, today we are living life in the way that you have taught us. Each day, each 24 hours. And right now, we are here with you where we belong. Thank you so much. Well, anyway, I went into these darn old PTA meetings with this woman. But I kid you not when I tell you that it is the women that have saved my life. Now, the men have helped me with my spiritual program now and then. In fact, you know, when I was sitting up there at this clubhouse, this Allen Nest, my mother and my daughter had gotten together a couple of days before, and they were going through the dictionary like I had been taught, and they had come up with how I was prior to coming into AA, and they had come up with two words, submissive and subservient. And that's kind of a person I was. I was very submissive and subservient. And I had gone to the meeting the next day up there at the clubhouse, and I was sitting there talking about this, of how submissive and subservient I was, and there was this young man sitting in the meeting, And he was tapping on the table. You know how they are when you're talking, you know, and they've got something important to say. And finally I finished what I was saying, and they called on him, and he looked over at me, and he pointed his finger right straight at me, and he said, "Lady, did you ever stop to think that all you ever really was just a kiss ass?" He hurt my feelings. But I got even with him. I married him. We women do have a way of getting even, guys. Might take us a while, but we'll get there. You know, I got to tell the ladies something, too. You know, I don't care from where you come from when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you've been the biggest prostitute out there on the streets, when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have been reborn. Now, if you don't believe me, you watch these men watching these newcomer women. They can't hardly wait to be the first one. They really think they're going to be the first one, too, you know. When you guys are going to start getting better, it's when you're going to want to start loving the hell out of these women instead of the hell that's in them. And when your program is really going to improve, it's when you want to be the last one in these women's lives, not the first one. That's going to improve. You know, I always used to think that it was poor little O'Neill that was always so abused by you guys. I really did. I have learned that you men do cry, that you do hurt. And I used to think you just walked away from these little affairs scot-free. So let's us women remember, these men do cry. They do hurt. They do not always walk away scot-free. I've met some of these women on this program, and I'm telling you, we got some real barracudas in here. So let's us be as honest and as kind and as gentle with them as we would want them to be with us. I think that's only fair. Yes, sir. Anyway, I'm in heat and I'm in trouble and I'm full of fear one more time. Fear and pain back in my life because I am scared to death that I'm going to end up back on the juice again. And so by this time now, I have got into my fourth step. And in my fourth step, I have learned the principle of truth, because in there it says that we are going to do some fact-facing and some fact-finding now. And so I took a look. I took a look at these men that I had chosen in my life. Let me tell you, you know what they were. They had charm, polish, and prestige. They were good looking, fun loving, hard drinking, party going, woman chasing. God damn, what a challenge, huh? Whee! And we got them. Oh, Lord, we got them. Damn near killed us, but we got them. And like was told earlier this afternoon from our Al-Anon sponsor, and we alcoholic women aren't any different. When we get them, we're not going to let go of them, because we know what's going to happen. She's going to get him. And when she gets him, he's going to sober up. He's going to become a faithful, loyal, hardworking husband. We've lost them. We're not going to let go, because we know they have such potential. Yeah. God, when I hear that word, I want to throw up. They've got such potential. And so we hold on to them. And that's what I did. And that's what we do. And Lord, I learned to let go and let God. Remember, I got those out of my first three principles. I can't, he can, so let him. And I was real willing to let him, I'll tell you, because of the pain and the fear in my heart. Now, I'm going to skip over the fifth step, and I'll come back to that. I think my time is about to run out. I don't know when I started. It's not running out yet? Okay. What time is it supposed to run out? Anyway, here I am, and I'm in this problem, and I don't know exactly what to do, and I'm doing now everything I can. Now, as I said, my principle there was in my sixth step. It talks about, I am going to quit here in a few minutes. I really am. I went into my sixth step. And in the sixth step, you know, where it says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character, right? God knows I was entirely ready. Now, I got to tell you, in there, I learned the principle of courage. And I think it was Ken that talked about it yesterday morning when he said, courage is the word that means from the heart, from the heart. I was entirely ready because I was scared to death. You know, they talk about this being a selfish program. I got to tell you that everything that I have done in this program, I have done for selfish reasons. Because of my fear and pain and afraid that if I didn't do what I was told to do, that I was going to end up back on the juice again. And beside that, I found out when I did these things, I felt so much better. I just felt so much better, you know. And so I became entirely ready. I got the courage. In the fifth step, now I had learned the principle of trust in that fifth step, and now I've got the courage to go with that trust. And then in the sixth step, and then the seventh step, you know, where it said that we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings, and there was where I got the faith to go with the trust and the courage. Now, on the 21st of August, just a couple of weeks ago, Hugh and I celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. And on Thursday, August the 22nd, our doctor informed us that my husband has lung cancer. Now, the central fact in our lives today, and it's come through our third step, is an absolute fact. Absolute. That our Creator has entered into our lives in such a way. In such a way. That it's an absolute miracle. And that He is accomplishing for us today what we could not do by ourselves. And I remember when I got into our fifth step, as I said, I learned the principle of trust. And in that fifth step, it says that we have to tell someone all of our life story, all of it, omitting nothing. For if we do, we may not overcome drinking. And in fact, it goes on to say that invariably we drank again. Now, I don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me when I read it. And I didn't know what to do because, you see, I didn't trust my sponsor. Eunice had a big mouth. Oh, God, she had a big mouth. And I knew the minute I told her my life story, she was going to come and tell you, and you were going to ask me to leave, that you didn't want me. But you see, as I said, I had come to trust in this God. Not Eunice. Not man. But in God, as I understood Him. And so I went to Eunice and I told her all of my life story, omitting nothing. And in doing so, Eunice shared a part of her life with me. And we developed a relationship, and it became a relationship of love. And as I then began to sponsor other women, and they came to me, and they shared a part of their life with me, we also developed a relationship. And it became a relationship of love in most cases. And isn't that what this book is all about? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book, our program, is all about. It's exactly. Now, I have one more pet peeve, and I'll get rid of that. We have a man over in our area, and I have heard him stand up at podiums and repeat something like this. I'd like to think that he didn't mean the way it sounded. Today I no longer have a drinking problem, I have a living problem. You ever heard anybody say that? If you're an alcoholic of my kind and you hear somebody say something like that to you, for Christ's sake, run. They can kill you. I came in this program and to you people because I was dying from alcoholism, from drinking alcohol. Not because of the problems I had. Not because of the problems I have today. But from drinking alcohol. I have living problems today. You darn right I have living problems. Hell, I'm breathing in and out. Do you know of anybody that's alive that doesn't have living problems? Are you like me? Did you come in here and think because you sobered up you was going to be immune from life and its problems? Because if that's what you've got in mind, let me tell you, you're in for one hell of a ride. There's a saying in this book that has held me in good stead. And I think it's terribly important for me to remember. It says, just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us and humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. And as I close here tonight, I want to wish for each and every one of you all of the things that I have found. You see, because when I got rid of self-righteousness, I gained some self-worth. I want to wish for you all the joy, all the sorrow, all the angers and frustrations, all the peace and contentment. Because you see, I thoroughly believe this, is that when our defects are removed, that we are left with just a few things. And that is harmony and peace and absolute love. Absolute love. And as I close, as I said, for each and every one of you, all of these things I wish. Because you see, these things are life. We are not immune from life. We're living life today. And that's what my husband said to me. He said, honey, I'm not dead yet. Don't bury me. You know, today we are living life in the way that you have taught us. Each day, each 24 hours. And right now, we are here with you where we belong. Thank you so much.